Okay, we'll start this again, and this is a slightly adjusted session at the Adelaide Writers' Week. My name is Sian Kane. As I said before, I'm Deputy Culture Editor of Guardian Australia, and we are gathered on the lands of the Kaurna people, and their sovereignty was never ceded, and I'm really grateful to be on their land and to acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people here today. I'm not with Miranda France, who we are going to continue trying to make contact with, but I'm here with the wonderful Louise Adler, who is director of the Adelaide Writers' Week.
Thank you so much.
So we thought we'd have a discussion about the book. Would you mind giving us a show of hands, I guess, if you've read The Writing School by Miranda France? No,
very few.
Can I ask as well, who in this audience wants to write a book? Excellent. Okay. Who has thought about writing a book and then gave up on it? Okay, yeah. It's quite a lot of hands from the sound desk. This is a really wonderful book, and I guess to give it a little introduction, that both Louise and myself have read this book. Essentially, Miranda France has written a couple of non-fiction books and also some fiction. But as is the case for a lot of writers, they also have to subsidise their income by teaching writing. And it's more and more common these days that authors do this. The book charts a four-day course that she does with 12 writers in the British countryside. The structure of it is really clever because she applies the lessons that she's asking her students to do to her own writing. So she puts herself through the same lessons that she's asking of her students. And I just found it really thrilling. It's sort of got a forensic
Indeed.
Tone to it about, I guess, the art of writing and the ethics of writing. And as someone, I'm a journalist, I've not written any books. It's really invigorating to read.
Do you think that you can teach people to write?
This is the question, and it's something that Miranda wrestles with in this book, and I've always wondered whether it is something that can be taught. I feel like it's absolutely something that can be learned, and I think the best lessons that people can get is through reading books. And it's not to say that you can't be taught things around writing. I think you can be taught certain self-awareness. I think you can be made aware of quirks in your own writing to avoid that perhaps makes your writing more polished and better. But what makes a good book is so individual to each and every one of us. To then try and teach someone how to write a good book is almost an impossible task, I think. And Miranda mentions Alice Munro in this book. And I don't know, are you a fan of Alice
Yes.
Munro? I love Alice Munro. And she's just a wonderful short story writer. She's 92 now. She doesn't write anymore, but she had this sort of remarkable career as a short story writer. And the amazing thing about Alice Munro is that she went to university, I think, for 2 years because she got a scholarship. And she didn't finish her university degree because she ran out of money. The scholarship ended and she didn't have money to finish her education. So she upped and moved so her husband could work in a department store. And she began writing short stories because it was something she could fit in between being a mother. And she is the most astounding writer. There are writers that, spend quite a lot of money on writing courses that are now very acclaimed today that sort of talk about her with a kind of reverence, like she's a wizard or something. And she's essentially entirely self-taught. Mm. And perhaps the thing, and I've always tried to figure out how she is so good, and perhaps part of why she is so good, and I think this is something, is that her husband and her opened a bookshop. And she's clearly spent her life just completely immersed in the writing of others. And I think that is something that can help you shape your writing.
And do you think you should, one practices with the short story as a form? I keep on thinking it's Patricia Highsmith, who's known for her bleak view of humanity. But she has one collection is called Little Tales of Misogyny. And the first short story is probably 1.5 pages long. And it's about a young man who asks for his beloved's hand in marriage. And he is given he asks the father of his beloved for her hand in marriage. And he is presented with her hand. and she walks thereafter with her handless arm in a muff, and he ends up mad and in an institution because he couldn't understand what was wrong with asking for someone's hand in marriage. And Patricia Highsmith does it in a page and a half. It's so economical. It's so brilliant. And I think that the short story is as hard to get right as the full-length novel.
Oh, but, absolutely. You know, yes. I think it's the discipline that's required. You know, I think it's... So I'm a journalist and I'm also an editor, so I edit a lot of other people's writing, and I'm far more impressed when someone can do 500 words that are perfect than 2,000 words that are just waffle.
And guilty of 2,000 words, guilty of excess.
I think it's easier to write long.
Yes,
I think
it is. Oh, yes.
You sort of, and I think sometimes some people wrongly assume, and I also, you know, I even bring this down to the word level. Some people wrongly assume that the longer the piece, the longer the word, the more impressive it is. And that's absolutely not the case.
And it's very hard, the economy of it. Yeah. And I must say one thing. I read the Miranda France last year, so, and of course there's lots of reading involved in this kind of event. So it's not uppermost fresh in my mind. But I do remember she's very funny in it. I mean, I think everybody who's been to a creative writing program, you know, the assembly of characters that come to do, you know, writing, creative writing courses can be entertaining themselves. And I don't know how many, I never get the title right, which my husband thinks is very Freudian of me. I can't remember whether it's Don't Throw Mama from the Train or Throw Mama from the Train, right? And Danny DeVito is in a creative writing program and he just besieges and pursues and harasses the guy who's running the program and he's just always showing him a paragraph and wanting feedback. So forgive me, I can't tell you what the title is really, but it is well worth reading. And it's sort of those of us who would like to write but have never written a book, it's sort of, it gives you hope, but it also sort of levelling our aspirations and fantasies about what kind of book we might write. So anyway, so there's that story.
Can I ask you, do you want to write a book?
No, because... I've been thinking about the writers here and the distinctiveness of the project. And two sort of quite different projects. I have adored is the wrong word, but been absolutely bowled over by Nathan Thrall's A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, not just because of the content, but because the kind of smallness of the conceit. And that he takes a day in the life. I think some of you probably have heard, or many of you might have heard him talk here, but it's a day in the life of a father who's trying to find out what happens to his little boy who's on a bus that's in an accident, a kindergarten excursion, and he's on a bus. So it's a micro history. It's a story of one day in the life of a Palestinian man. From that little micro story, he enlarges to give us a sense of the occupation, what it means to live under occupation. I'm not talking to the politics of the environment, but it's the structural device that he uses that I thought was so clever. So there's Nathan Thrall on one hand, and then the other sort of quite distinct project was Jonathan Rosen's The Best Minds, which is the story, and some of you will have heard him here earlier in the week, and he talks about his friendship with a wunderkind, very brilliant friend. They're very close. They come from a family of, both come from families of academics, very interested in psychiatry and psychoanalysis, deeply steeped in culture and so on and so forth. And Jonathan Rosen's dear friend declines into schizophrenia by the time he's 19. So it's a personal story, but it's interwoven with an extraordinarily rich and interesting, deep history of mental health, the failings of the mental health system in the US. And I always yearn for writers in Australia to take on the big themes and the big histories and how one might do it. And I wonder whether we are an understated people and think that that's not the kind of way we write, the sort of books that Americans write all the time, the big histories that are kind of brought down, you know, with the human element to it, and that we don't do this. And the counterpart would, of course, be something as sort of economical as Murray Bale's Eucalyptus. I don't know if you remember reading it. It's tiny, perfectly, I think it's a jewel of a book, but it's the absolute reverse of the big history. So I just think it's a very interesting, the kind of choices people make and the way in which they create the stories.
Yeah. I think... You know, there's so much about my career. You know, so I'm a journalist and I used to work for the books desk at The Guardian in London. So all day, every day, I was surrounded by books, and it's sort of the dream job if you love reading. You know, you're just all day being asked what you think about literature. You're comparing books. You're, you know, dissecting why things work and why they don't. But I think there is something in that when you admire the work of others so well, it makes you realise more and more that you never want to do it yourself. And it's not necessarily even just about how hard it is, because it is so hard. And, you know, there is a kind of ineffable quality to some books about why they are so good, that you could sort of submit it to a forensic investigation about why it works and why it doesn't. And, you know, that would be completely different for you and for me, or, you know, someone in the audience might hate it, or, you know. Just that, I think, that sort of impossibility of trying to measure why a book works and why it doesn't, it kind of deters you in some ways from wanting to do it, just because I see how heartbreaking it is when people get a book published and they think that that means that they will be read. And those are two very different things. And I think some writers are pretending when they say they are only writing for themselves. They are obviously writing for an audience. And
I have, I don't want to interrupt, but I have, when I used to be at Melbourne University Publishing, I do remember one academic said, I proudly write for two peers. And I thought, I think that's a bit of a pity, yeah. You know, and that she was really happy with an audience of two and the world. Because I think one should write for an audience. Yes. One should say, who's my audience? And often academics would say, well, Auntie Beryl and, you know, my academic peers and, you know, and the world at large are all going to be interested. And I think, actually, it's either for Auntie Beryl or it's for the world at large or it's for your academic peers. And actually, it mostly doesn't work if you kind of want to cross those, you know, various audiences.
Yes. You know. And I think even the nature of writing is so intimate and so... you know, driven by personal feeling, like, especially for writing novels, I think that you kind of have to be driven by emotion and feeling and wanting to be read, and because it's so much about reading is an act of empathy, that then when no one's reading your book, it's the most heartbreaking thing in the world. I used to work as a bookseller in Adelaide, actually. I used to work at the Dimmicks, and, you know, you'd be asked to do returns. And so you'd be pulling books off the shelf and peeling the sticker off, and you'd be sending it back to the publisher to be returned because it didn't sell.
We don't call them returns, or we call them distress stock in the industry. It's just distress. We don't want to know, you know, like...
Even the word distressed, it's so emotive. These little distressed books.
Trying to overcome the fact that they didn't sell.
But you just, the more and more I did this, you know, I was in that shop because I read so much and I loved it. And, you know, as soon as you love books and you read books, you spend your life being asked, oh, when will you write your book? And more and more I go, absolutely never. I'm never doing it. It's just too
heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. But it's interesting how many of us in our business worked in bookshops. I worked in the equivalent of W.H. Smith in Israel, and the man who owned the sort of W.H. Smith or the Dimmicks equivalent was a guy called, I don't know what his first name was, Mr. Stymatsky. And Mr. Stymatsky was, and I think it's, I don't know how to put it in neutral language, a rather large person, a person of large build. And he had the license, the sole license in Israel for the distribution of Playboy and Penthouse. I'm going back quite a long way. And he personally would sit there with a texter or whatever the Israeli equivalent is and block out, redact any evidence of genitalia. And that was his, I think, particular pleasure, not just a business obligation. So, but I've never forgotten. But you end up, I don't know whether you felt like this, I have always, to this day, had great pleasure in being able to pack a box of books efficiently.
Oh, yes.
You know, there's a sort of, maybe it's a bit OCD or, you know, compulsive, but, you know, it's like the pleasure in packing properly, but it's
never leaves you. I mean, never leaves. I'll go into the bookshops, like I'll go into a Dimmicks and I'll find myself reshelving things so it looks more aesthetically pleasing.
As opposed to me, who as a publisher would go in and, for my sins, I published, I don't know how many of you would know the name Mick Gatto, who's, you know, we call him the Professor of Industrial Relations, you know. I went into one of the airport bookshops and I rearranged the stock. And publishers pay for, well, the major publishers who can afford it, pay for shelving. You know, they pay for space. And so I just covered up some other, you know, rivals' books with my stock. And a phone call came through, and I think it was, maybe we were with, I can't remember which distributor with, and they said, look, we don't want to make any trouble, the distributors, the sales reps, but we're rather concerned. It seems that one of Mick Gatto's associates has been promoting his book inappropriately. I did not confess that actually, I'm not an associate, but it wasn't one of his friends with, you know, hair rugs and vinyl jackets. It was me who was helping the thing. So I didn't do it anymore because they were trying to be very nice in case Mick Gatto or one of his associates came to visit. So
you're the publisher every author dreams of. Isn't
it? But it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. But you feel, you know, you want to showcase your authors. Anyway, so back to business, back to writing.
Yeah.
So
I think there's an interesting, and I often encounter this that, you know, someone that writes about books, I'd often be asked, even by like writers who were perhaps, you know, critics and journalists but had never been published before, about how the publishing industry works. Mm-hmm. And I think it is slightly opaque, you know, from the outside that, you know, people know the terms publisher and agent and, you know, all these sorts of things, but they don't perhaps know the way in which to go about it. There's a character in this book with Miranda. There's a student that comes to her workshop. His name's Peter. He's an older bloke. And, you know, he comes fully armed with a manuscript. Some people are coming in with the sort of the scraps of ideas, and some people have kind of been pushed there by family members to go and do this writing course. You know, some people have, you know, written chapters of a book, but not a full thing. He comes in with a full manuscript and tells her very early on that he's only there because he wants to be introduced to her agent, and that... in return, if she introduces him to her agent, he will tell her where all the errors in one of her books are. And she declines, unsurprisingly. But it's so interesting just about the attitude that I guess some people have towards publishing, because there is sometimes, you know, there is this thing that everyone has a story, and I do think that that is true in some ways, but I also think that sometimes there is a certain attitude of entitlement, I think, sometimes to having a book published, and that of course everyone thinks their own work is good, and they aren't always receptive to feedback, even when they've signed up for something like a workshop where you are sort of paying someone to tell you this is what you can do better, this is what's great, you know, that sort of thing.
It's very difficult, isn't it? It's very difficult. Sometimes, you know, we would get a lot of, you know, family memoirs, and, you know, you would put it politely, but what you were thinking... And we would have a poison taster. They were called the poison taster, who would go through the unsolicited manuscripts pile, you know, and you'd get lots of them every month. You know, some people, if you look at publishers' websites, some now say, do not accept unsolicited manuscripts, do not bother writing, just we will not respond, we won't even acknowledge that you actually sent us something. Mm-hmm. And some publishers are more generous, and some publishers actually have a day a month, I think, where they actually respond to pitches. So every publisher in Australia, I think, takes a different position on, you know, the unsolicited manuscript. But I do think in terms of family memoirs, and it's hard to be categoric, because some family memoirs, you know, personal memoirs, have been extraordinary. The happiest man, Jakku, I can't remember. Huge seller. It's been hugely successful. Mm. I think that if I had received that, I would have said to him, look, it's very interesting, but maybe you should go to Officeworks and print off, you know, 50 copies for the family and distribute it. I would have been completely wrong and completely misjudged the market. But, you know, so some of the personal, stories have been... So I was thinking while you were talking of Edmund Duval's The Hair with Amber Eyes. And none of us had heard, I had not, and maybe other people had, I had not heard of him. And one person said to another person who said to another person, you need to write this book. It's about his very wealthy French family of immigrants, very wealthy, and a sort of passion for, he's a ceramicist who works with Japanese ceramics. It's an extraordinary idiosyncratic history that has become, you know, was a bestseller. He wasn't known, so it's so, all the rules that one thinks apply don't apply in the end, which makes it very hard for people who think, oh, I've got a story worth telling.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking then of, I don't know how to say his last name, I usually only read it and don't hear it aloud, Raymond Gaita? Gaita?
Gaita, Ray Gaita.
Romulus, My Father, which was developed into a memoir and a book because one of his friends heard him deliver his father's eulogy and just went, that's a whole book. Mm. You missed.
What about the edict, you know, the fiat, write what you know? Mm. I think my instinct is to say write what you don't know, because actually it will take you past your own sort of, you know, your own personal history. What's your view of that? Do you think that people should write what they know?
It's interesting, I guess, because I think that there is safety in writing what you know, certainly, and there is something incredibly restrictive about that as well that I find unexciting as a reader. You know, I want writers that will take the risk. And often it's sometimes these conversations that happen around, you know, who should write what. I often find it's kind of applying like an individual thinking to a structural problem. So, you know, for instance, if you have, you know, these conversations occasionally happen, it's most often in America, where, you know, you'll have a writer who perhaps, you know, a white writer that might write an Asian character and it's terrible, but it gets published anyway. And a lot of people are cross at that writer and they say, you know, you shouldn't write Asian characters, but actually another writer could if they did a good job. And then you just start going, okay, but what makes a good job and a bad job? And I always think that actually, you know, it's not wrong to criticize authors when they do a bad job, but I also think that it's applying kind of an individual approach to a wider structural problem, which is there aren't enough published Asian writers. So I generally sort of think that there's, you know, I think everyone should, yeah, write what you know, write what you don't know, take risks, and hopefully it's really good. But that, you know, it's not necessarily going to be just because you're a published author.
So to the kind of constraints for publishers, I worked briefly for Hachette, which is a very, very good and commercially very successful publishing company. They've done brilliant, they do very, you know, they do terrific books, serious books, mass market books, they do a variety of books. But it was very interesting to work with them through the process. You're talking about writing what you know and the drama that ensued around, and I cannot remember her name, the Puerto Rican writer, American Dirt. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, this is terrible, terrible. I hate doing this.
Not American Dirt.
Jean.
That was, I think I
don't remember. She's writing about immigrants, Mexican immigrants.
Yes, that was American Dirt.
American Dirt. Yeah. And there was a huge issue about this. Okay, they had been, you know, publicists, I think publicists are brilliant and they come up with very creative ways to promote books, but the marketing campaign was probably ill-judged, maybe is the way to put it. And they had a launch party. I think it might have been in America,
yeah,
where they had her at a signing table with barbed wire around it. And you know, that sort of started a big discussion about the appropriateness, and that then took off from there, the appropriateness of a Puerto Rican writer writing about, you know, and Mexicans, Mexican individuals trying to cross the border into the States, and that she had no right. And I think Latino writers were feeling that she had no right to this story, no authenticity. It's a big challenge today, isn't it? And do we say in the end, if your writing's good, it's okay, but if your writing's bad, then, you know, you shouldn't be writing about something you don't know. Is that where we land on this question?
I feel like that's where a lot of people land, and they kind of accept the broad, I guess, crumbs of truth in that. But also when you sort of put any scrutiny on that phrase, you start going, okay, but what is good and what is bad? Is it good because it was published? Is it bad because,
correct,
you know, it was overlooked? And so often you read something that's published and you go, this is terrible, how did this get published? So all these metrics that you could try and measure whether a piece of literature works or doesn't is going to sort of differ between all of us. So I don't think it actually holds up under scrutiny, that argument. Because taking that as an example, you know, so much of the furor started when the pictures from this launch party for this book came out, and there was this barbed wire around baskets of, I think, appetizers or something. Like, it's just very thoughtless and
I'd be gentle to them and say they probably thought very hard and thought it was a brilliant idea.
And I think part of the backlash to it, you know, partly, you know, I think some of it's just purely thoughtless, but also I think this book had the backing of Oprah from memory. It was picked for the book club. So then it started being a question about was this book, did it deserve the elevation that it had had? And I don't think there's any firm answer to it.
No,
I think it would differ. You know, some people would have loved that book.
And it was extremely successful,
yes,
despite all the static, which is so interesting.
Yeah.
It was extremely successful here.
And some of that, and this is an interesting thing that Miranda France writes about, is that these are sort of things that that writers don't think about when they're at the manuscript stage, is that so much of whether their book is a success will have nothing to do with what they've written. Will have to do with whether they're seen as marketable. So often that is actually increasingly leveled at younger writers, that they, you know, they can be shaped at the start of their career. That's quite appealing to some publishers. But also whether you get the backing of the marketing team. And, you know, the marketing team, you know, they will put essentially quite a lot of money behind certain books and nothing at all behind others. And that's not often to do with quality. That's not a metric. Mm. It's just whether is it actually something that's really easy to sell to a large group of people.
But it's so complicated. You know, so your publishing clout, your clout as a publisher, your financial capacity as a publisher can get you the front, you know, the front window of Dimmicks here, you know, or in George Street in Sydney, and that has a major impact. But I don't think that always produces sales. It's interesting. It's so unscientific. I've always been dazzled. And, you know, very smart people work in publishing. It's so unscientific. It's put your finger up in the wind and take a punt and, you know, it's as... authors think that it's scientific, and we have met. You know, I've talked to Lenore Taylor about how she understands how you know your readership, how much of your content, you know, how much of a piece your audience, your readers are reading, and the metrics and the capacity to discern the data analysis you can do is amazing. We have so little of it in publishing. So it's all fly by the seat of your pants. In a way, I hope publishers are not in the audience. And, you know, but I've been guilty of myself. And you back books that you believe in, and then you're devastated when they don't. You know, you think, you know, I published a book. Probably none of you will remember him. His name was Andrew Reimer. He was a wonderful, I think, chief reviewer at the Sydney Morning Herald. And he did this beautiful book about his own. It was called A History of Smoking. You know, probably couldn't even do it today, but it was a history of smoking, Budapest family, a sort of particular moment, a particular period in the middle of the Second World War. Exquisite book. If he'd been published in America or in Europe, he would have been lauded. It sort of had such a small readership. People reviewed it beautifully. Your heart is broken for, you know, when you know the book is beautiful, and then you look at some of the books that you think are not so great and have getting very wide, you know, coverage and celebrated. So it's a very unscientific business. Heartbreaking.
And lots of the success can sometimes be a simple, you know, books reach a certain momentum, I think, and you'd see it as a bookseller that you'd have people coming in and they'd go, oh, I don't know the title, but it's blue. And I would know exactly what they were after because there'd be one blue book that was doing really well.
Yellowface is an example, isn't it? Yes. Yellowface, but you know about Yellowface, don't you? The success of that book, because that's an interesting case study, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. Yellowface is, I think her name's Arif Chang, I think. And she's written this book, and it's sort of a study of the publishing industry and kind of a satire, I guess.
Not funny at all, but really, she's accurate.
Do you know, I've had so many conversations with people who felt really kind of betrayed that the book had slightly been marketed as more funny than it is. But it, because a lot of it is, you know, quite serious and devastating. But essentially a writer who sort of adopts an Asian identity and takes advantage of a sort of, I guess, a well-meaning but quite cynical motivation in the publishing industry to promote her, and just everything she sort of ends up doing to avoid being caught as a white writer pretending to be Asian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's like even thinking of like American Fiction, the film that's nominated at the Oscars this year, which is based on a novel, also that, you know, have this African-American writer who, you know, writes books that basically no one reads, and sees other African-American writers writing books that he thinks are really, you know, awful, reductive, stereotypical novels about growing up in the ghetto and all this sort of stuff, things that aren't his experiences. And with his agent sort of, as a sort of joke, decides to write one of these books himself, and then it becomes a huge success. And he has to sort of adopt this persona of sort of this, you know, very streetwise African-American author, this sort of thing that he's been making fun of his whole career privately, he has to adopt as a public persona to sort of hide the artifice. So there is a lot of this, I think there's a lot of scrutiny of publishing.
Yes.
And because it is an inexact science, as you say, but...
And a very predominantly, you know, it's an educated middle class, predominantly white industry, which is a problem today, isn't it? Because you're not even representing, you know, the diversity of, for example, Australian community.
Yeah.
So we're a bit behind the times, it seems to me. But I think people are now conscious of that
and
conscious of remedying that and being open and responsive to other voices. You know?
Yes. Well, there was always a thing that you'd said every year when I was working at The Guardian in London that you'd get these studies that would come out of the UK and the US of the publishing industry and the makeup of it. And it was always between about 89 and 96% white workforce, mm-hmm. mostly young women, mm-hmm. With a few men at the top sort of skewing the gender pay. So, you know, not indicative of wider society at all, but also quite a weird little mm-hmm. bubble in and of mm-hmm. itself as well at the same time.
I think you asked a little bit, I don't know whether people are, do you want me to talk a little bit about, the publishing, the process? Do you want me to?
Yeah, well, I think that's actually quite interesting, especially if lots of people are writing books. Yeah.
So it's a, it's a very difficult I'm sorry? Yes. Correct. Fair enough. The gentleman would like us to focus on creative writing. And you agree? I am. I'm in receipt of creative writing, but he'd like to understand the process. Let's focus on fiction. Maybe we should focus on fiction. Would you be happy with that? I think there are creative. We do believe that there's creative nonfiction. So I would sort of say just as important to focus on nonfiction as fiction. But let's talk about that. So in terms of fiction, it's very hard. In terms of the process, very hard to get publishers' attention. I am going to talk about the publishing process because that's what I know about. I'm not a novelist. Often it helps to have, as we talked about short stories, that the route is to get published first in literary magazines and to build up a body of work that shows that literary magazine editors have thought your work was worth publishing. That helps you get a start. I think it's very difficult, approaching publishers directly doesn't work. In 99% of the time, that's not the way. So then you have to find an agent. Equally difficult because there are not that many literary agents in the country, and they are highly selective, and of course they earn their keep by publishing already published successful writers. So everything's against the new, novice novelist. It's not by design, but that's the structure. The system is set up against it. So very hard to penetrate it. It's a long process. You have to be, so even if you get through and you get commissioned, the financial rewards, well, one would have to say you need a day job because the financial rewards are not there. The standard fee would be, we call them an advance, and it'd be 10% of the recommended retail price will go to the author. So there's no way it in any way is commensurate with the work involved, the years involved in writing a novel. So you need a day job, and nobody makes a living out of writing apart from maybe, there'd be 5 or 6 people in Australia who are making a living from their writing today. I think maybe 10, yeah. I would say between 5 and 10 who actually can write full-time and survive. And then there's the attenuated process of working with an editor. Publishing process is slow. It can take anywhere between 6 months to 2 years because there's the editing process, the copy editing process, and then there's getting in the queue of when the publisher can publish you and what point of the year is the right point in the year to publish the particular novel that you've written. So it's a very attenuated process. I think writers can feel either enlivened, enriched, inspired by the editing process or really alienated by it. So finding the chemistry and the right fit between the editor and the novelist is also really difficult and can be brilliant or it can be, an unhappy experience. I always remember that I published Marion Halligan for a while, who's now no longer with us, and I thought she was a wonderful writer. She has a particular rhythm to her prose. And I said something about the way she used semicolons. I think the younger generation, you think, don't know what a semicolon is. I'm particularly partial to a semicolon. But anyway, I'm going to hold on to the semicolon. And I said something very mild. I was rebuffed. It was clearly not something she was going to take on board. However, in every launch she did thereafter when there was a book published, she said, I want to pay tribute to my editor, Louise Adler, for her wise editorial judgment. I thought, hello, Marion, you resisted my tiny, tiny comment because it's her work and her voice. And I think that the role of the editor is to be the intelligent, empathic interlocutor. And all you can do is ask the questions and pose the questions in a way that might be considered. But it's your work in the end. It's not my work. It's your work and it's your voice. And you have to hold on to that. And then after it's published, that's a lovely thing. And then you wait for reviews that can be extremely painful. I don't think we're living in the most viciously critical review culture here, but they can be, some can be, you know, any criticism can be devastating. But I think where it's a fairly generous review culture, you'd be better equipped than I am to speak about that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, I think quite often we'll be asking, you know, critics and authors, and often they come to, you know, festivals and do a lot of work here in between things. So a lot of the culture is very small. So sometimes you do encounter people saying to you, oh, I know you commissioned me to review this book, but I actually think it's rubbish and I won't review it for you because I don't want to write a bad review. And so any idea that people are motivated by this sort of drive to take something down and be vicious about it is absolutely not my experience at all. I think often you're trying to encourage people to, you know, apply that critical thought and, you know, not necessarily be vicious, but you know, I think a bad review can be as instructive to a reader as a glowing.
Instructive to the reader, but the author never gets over it.
Oh, no. It's terrible. And then it's terrible for the critic and the author's relationship going forward. You get lots of frosty glances across festivals like this for years. But just in regards to that man's comment, just about creative writing, because I think, you know, I it's interesting. I don't think there is necessarily, you know, I think if you're writing to be published, I think it's sometimes really instructive to know how the publishing process works once you've done, because so much of what you do before that point is entirely up to you. You know, the amount of rigor and time that you apply to your writing and how you go about testing yourself and building your skills will be up to you. And that's sort of something that Miranda France goes into, that she sometimes feels a little bit helpless. She's sort of hovering over these writers while they do this exercise that she's sent them. So one of the exercises she does that I think sounds really interesting is she gets her writers in this workshop to pair up. And one of them will get a piece of paper and cut a little strip out of the paper. And then they go outside and they find a part of the horizon or some part of the landscape around them and isolate that. And then they have to go back and describe just what they see through that one little viewfinder that they've cut from the paper. And they have 15 minutes to do it. And so it really vigorous sort of sort of short things, and then what would happen is then that the person they're paired with would read that the little passage that they've written and then go and try and find what they were looking at. So it's wonderful, you know, it's sort of both interpretation, it's kind of critical thinking, both parties are sort of benefiting in different ways, and then they swap. And so there's sort of instances in this that are, you know, interesting little thought experiments, but a lot of it just simply comes down to what each of those writers are bringing in on their first day. And a lot of it is driven by their willingness. So, for example, I mentioned Peter before, who was sort of blackmailing Miranda to speak to her agent. I think on day two, he comes up to her and he goes, oh, no, this is all very silly. I don't want to do any of this. And she's, okay. But he's paid to be there, and he's paid to be there because he thinks that he's done enough. He's done enough of the work, and he's written his book, and he just needs her contacts her agent. Yeah.
So we should take questions if people want to line up. But is there? I'm sorry, I haven't got a copy of the book. But is there something you might read to give people a flavour of it?
There is actually, and this was always the thing that I felt slightly sad about Miranda not being here, was because there's so much humour in it, and there was actually a section that I thought would be really nice to read. What was the point of any of it, you might think? Being a writer requires an arsenal of conflicting qualities, a supreme self-belief married to humility, a determination to succeed together with the strength to deal with failure. You have to aim high because the middle distance is too pointless, too fuzzy a goal. You want to have success more than anything. John Cheever dreamt of his face on a stamp, while accepting that it isn't that big a deal if you don't get it. The legion of once rejected authors parades before us, J.K. Rowling, Sarah Waters, James Joyce. In 1797, Pride and Prejudice was declined by return of post by publisher Thomas Cadell, and Jane Austen waited another 16 years before finding a publisher. It's sold 20 million copies since then. My own father's rejected manuscript on the development of selfhood in children used to lie for days on the doormat before he stooped to pick it up. Rejection is built into the experience of writing. But almost worse than the stories of rejections are the ones about wasted time. The people who spend years, decades on a book that may never be read or be quickly remaindered or sold for resurfacing roads. She's just, which is true. And she says in there that she's heard a rumor that apparently a lot of the stock that the Oxfam secondhand bookshops get goes to making asphalt.
That's terrible.
Again, I spoke about heartbreak at the start, and that's certainly it. Hi.
Thank you, Louise, for another amazing week.
Thank you.
Just a question. What book would you want to see written that tells the big story in Australia? So just a topic.
Let me think about it while we're, what we haven't done. What's the big idea? Can I mull over it while we're listening? Thank you.
I'm a retired university science lecturer, and I have written academic works and a textbook. How should I go about moving into creative fiction or creative writing? Probably non-fiction, but I'm not sure.
Mm. Well, go on.
I would say that a lot of it would be, I guess, setting yourself exercises and doing a lot of reading, sort of determining what it is you find admirable about a book yourself. And I say this as someone that's never written a book, mind you, but I think it's the thing that Miranda writes about in this book is that a lot of people really want to write books and they don't want to read books. And so much can be learned from reading books that I think, going out and experimenting and reading things and deciding what you like and don't like and then figuring out why you like it. What can you emulate? What can you learn from books? And there's always this thing about, writers starting out and copying who they love. But there is something in that because then you start putting your own twist on it. Even imperceptibly, you start making it your own voice. So I think if you settle on an idea or settle on something that you find exciting and personally sort of motivating, you could do something like go to a creative writing course. And she has people that go to her workshop that say to her, I've got no idea what I want to do. I might write a memoir. And she works with them. And I think part of it is that first step of writing something. You need to write something, however rubbish, to make it better, And a lot of people live with the idea of a book in their head, but they don't ever actually put it down. And so much of the work comes after you've put it down. So perhaps just starting, call yourself a writer,
Be a writer. You are a writer. You're already a science writer. But now be a writer. But you could also, if I may encourage you, what we need are good science writers in the public sphere. Mm. People who take their academic research. This was always my obsession at MUP. Take the research, the scholarship and the research and the work you've done over all these years and tell us, the general community, why. Because I think there's, we know there's brilliant work being done by our scientists. Tell it to the public. You're a hungry public who want to understand, stuff that's specialised, problems in our society that are specialised that you know about, and that's what you know about science, about the issues of the day or whatever your special, your discipline, specific discipline is. Share that with us, but find a way to write. This is my obsession. Find a way to write to engage me, who was told by my principal. Or my mother was, best Louise doesn't continue with maths and sciences at the end of year 7, right? So tell me. And he was right because it was enumerate, but anyway, it doesn't matter. But I think that, tell us why this mattered, that research mattered. We count on scientists to tell us about the world we're going to inherit, what the future we're going to leave our children. So go forth.
Yeah.
And can I just go back to the gentleman who asked me, so one of the passions that one of the issues I've never found a writer. Well, two things. I wanted a book written about reputation and I never found anyone who was willing to do it because it's my another obsession. Mm-hmm. I find it fascinating. The people who lose their reputation, who regain their reputation, how they're taken down in the public sphere, appalling people who find another life, who come back and are then respected and so on, how reputations are trashed by, not of course, Sian Kane, but some people in the mass media, and we won't mention them, but how people's reputations are made and broke, how they destroy themselves, for example, and how they then are redeemed. I think that's fascinating. I've never found anyone to write that. The other project that I always thought was interesting, very American project, was, I think his name's David Halberstam, and he wrote a series of books. I think he started with the 50s in America, the 60s in America, the 70s in America, describing, the history, the social movements. They were very readable great narratives to read, but they accounted for a decade. We've never done that kind of... We have slices. People have done slices of this and talked about, let's say, the 70s or, you know, the 1950s, growing up in Australia in the 1950s. But the bigger project, I would love that sort of work to be done here. Maybe I'm the only person that's interested in it. It would fall flat and, you know, we just get distressed stock back from the bookseller.
Hello.
Hello. I've got a bad voice today, unfortunately.
Oh, sorry.
I'm Nadine Williams, and I've written two books based on my diaries. Now the third book, Manuscript Stage, which is a historical drama of my forebears, Germans who came out in the mid-19th century. Thousands of descendants, Germans had loads of children, thousands in South Australia and everywhere else. My issue is this. I am using proper names. The families I come from are very, very famous in the Adelaide Hills. I'm writing about the Germanic settlement in the Adelaide Hills, not the Barossa. Mm. I am using proper names, and I'm getting a bit worried about it with the stories that I've found out about in my research, you know, not so pleasant ones. And I'm just wondering if there's any advice you can give me about looking, using real names, the names of people who... I'm a seventh generation, and all of us are seventh generations. So the reunions and the Lutheran archives are filled with, you know, histories of who begat whom. Mm. I'm trying to bring them to life, to tell the story of what happened in the Adelaide Hills with these people. Mm. Do you have any advice on using proper names?
I would say, like, do read this book, because Miranda essentially is being constantly asked by her students whether they have the right to write about people that are in their lives, write about their own lives, because, of course, when you're writing about your own life and your own story, you're not just writing about yourself, you're writing about people you know, and, you know, some of those people might be long dead, and some people, you have relatives that are still alive and you don't want to upset them. And then she writes about her family and what happened. And this was slightly sad. I did want to ask Miranda about what point did she actually get comfortable with it, because she does say in the book that she feels a slight envy when she's telling her students, oh, you know, it's your story, you write about it, because she was holding herself back because she didn't want to upset members of her family. I could give you some really brutal journalistic advice, which is you can't defame the dead, so go for it. If you want to be sensitive to these things, something she does in here, she has certain people that she only refers to by first initial. I don't know if that would work for your project, but it's something she does. You can always do the... Some names have been changed.
If you're alive and you can identify yourself, and the different laws apply in different states. But isn't that a problem? If you see yourself,
absolutely.
You are, you know, I say that's me in this book.
If it's defamatory, and maybe you can speak to this about, you know, in terms of having lawyers involved at the publishing stage, but often lawyers are involved if they are at all concerned about publishing anything, because, you know, often if there is a legal thing, then they will go for the publisher because they're the ones that have the money. I think it's about making that judgment, and maybe you do need to... I don't know whether it would be something you do at this writing stage or when you enlist a publisher to get that legal advice about whether it is. But, you know, maybe part of it will just have to be sitting in it and go, how happy am I to hurt some feelings potentially, especially in a small community like the Hills? I don't know if that's helpful, but yeah, it sounds fascinating.
Can't wait to read it.
Yes.
Craig.
My name's Daryl Regan from ABC Friends.
Hi.
I've got six grandchildren. When you look at the market for children's books, I'm wondering, it's in the billions. I was wondering, when you're looking at what book you'd like to write, children's books are incredibly popular. I was going to ask Louise, of the 10 people that make a living, can you identify how many would be children's authors?
Oh, probably at least half. Colin Hoover. Is that her name? Coho, hashtag Coho, the romance writer. She'd be making a living. She's definitely making a living. Andy Griffiths would be making, he's just immensely popular, brilliantly successful. Matthew Riley, who else would be, I can't remember, but at least three. Sally Rippon, correct? Correct, yes. Correct. She would be making a living, I think quite a large proportion. But in terms of living, so, you know, it's very basic, but the recommended retail price on books, on children's books, is much lower than on adult books. So they have to sell many more copies to earn a living than we do, but very successful. You know, it's great. It's the Australian children's and publishing is so vibrant. It's been wonderful.
It certainly, I think it's the case in Australia, the UK and the US that the most lucrative area is children's publishing, because people are so willing to buy books for children in ways that perhaps they're not willing to buy books for their friends and relatives that are adults.
And Mem Fox, let's not forget it, our South Australia's very own Mem Fox. Hope she's earning a living from it. She should be.
As a grandparent, I can recognise the amount of money that's involved.
Yes. Indeed.
I was just wondering if you can enlarge in any way on self-publishing. Is it successful? Could it achieve anything? Or is it just sort of for personal benefit?
Do you want to go?
Yeah, I could say so I've interviewed some self-published authors that are incredibly successful. Mm. There's a thriller writer called Rachel Abbott in the UK that's incredibly successful. The thing to know about her is she now is published by a publisher. So it can sometimes work out that way, that someone is self-published and is incredibly successful, and then a publisher will come on board and perhaps had put them on the slush pile and gone, oh, sorry, we got that wrong. We'll now invest, in your career. But the thing to know about Rachel's success was that she was spending 12 hours a day just on marketing. Because when you're self-published, you are taking care of your own marketing, unless you're willing to perhaps pay, a freelance person to do that for you. But, the act of publishing, self-publishing, that's, I wouldn't say that's anything to do with quality at all, but I guess if you want that readership, you will have to put some work into marketing. And that is a benefit of having a publisher, because they have those departments to do that for you and to, design your covers, for instance, right, which is something that people don't think about but may fall to you if you end up self-publishing. So there is a lot of work around that, the benefit of the publishing house is that they could do that for you. And so, Rachel was spending 12 hours a day, putting herself out there for talks, doing free, public readings. She was putting a lot of her money into Facebook ads. She was just doing a lot of ruthless self-promotion, and that doesn't leave you a lot of time to write. Mm. But she did get to a point where she, very successful.
And distribution. I mean, Sian hasn't talked about distribution, actually lugging the pallets, the boxes of books to various bookshops and trying to enjoin the booksellers. But you're personally doing that. You haven't got, unless you hire someone again who's got some clout to persuade individual booksellers to stock your book, is a really difficult thing, because they're inundated by, and publishers and titles. So it's very hard. So you've got to be almost like a complete little business organisation.
Thank you.
I would say that I had an author that when I was a bookseller, he had a publisher, and we had an order placed at this bookshop for 6 copies of a particular book. And what we didn't realise was that those books were never collected by the customer that ordered them, so they were put on the shelf. That was often the case if books weren't collected. It turned out the author himself had ordered those books, so they would be put on the shelf. And we caught him signing them, because if an author signs them, they can't be returned to the publisher.
Correct.
And there was a whole to-do. So I would say, don't do that if you think that's what's going to get your book on a bookshelf. Because, it was really distressing. And
I thought it was sounds very smart.
If he hadn't got caught, it would have been very, very,
very
admirable.
Entrepreneurial.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
Just a quick one. Thank you, Louise, for filling in. But you've mentioned Dimmicks twice, and I think that Dillons need a plug for...
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Could we give a round of applause to Dillons, who've been our bookseller for 2 years now, and I think one of the... there are brilliant bookshops in Adelaide, in South Australia, and Dillons is one of them.
Absolutely
superb. Superb
and
range.
Actually, let's also mention Imprints, because I love Imprints. Yes. It's one of the most beautiful bookshops in Australia. And they've just announced that they're selling. So if there's anyone motivated to buy a bookshop and keep it alive, it's a short walk to Hindley Street. Go bail them out.
So Sian is going to conclude, but I just wanted to ask you to join me in thanking Sian for her contribution to the festival, this session and many others. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And do read The Guardian and do read the culture and literary sections, because they are Very good.
And
very
can
good.
I please thank Louise, because what an act of absolute generosity to come and step in literally at the last minute. And I hope it's been enjoyable. I know it's probably not necessarily the talk you came to see, but I hope it's been entertaining at least.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.